This is Nancy Clare. Welcome to episode 62 of Speaking of Mysteries. Last month, when I participated in Book Passage's Mystery Writers Conference in Corte Madera, California, I got the chance to meet San Francisco-based writer Kelly Stanley, the creator of the Miranda Corby series of noir mysteries set in San Francisco in 1940 that include City of Dragons, City of Secrets, and her most recent, City of Ghosts, as well as two books in her Roman noir series featuring Arcturus, set in Roman Britain. I was thrilled when she agreed to an interview. Kelly talks a lot about the inspiration for both her series, including her next book in the Miranda Corby series, City of Sharks. Kelly's knowledge of the noir genre is both deep and wide, and our conversation was long and far-reaching. It was an education. Here's Kelly Stanley. Hello, welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. Our guest today is Kelly Stanley, who is the author of both the Miranda Corby series and the Arcturus series, which takes place in Roman Britain. So welcome, Kelly.
Thank you, Nancy. It's wonderful to be here, and always a joy to talk to you.
Oh, God. Well, you don't have to believe her.
It's true. No one knows how fun you can really be.
You write the two series that I just mentioned, and is there a specific reason your Miranda Corby series takes place in San Francisco in the early 40s before the U.S. has entered, at least the books so far, before the U.S. has entered World War II, and Arcturus is working as a physician in Roman Britain. So is there a reason that you chose those two particular time periods?
You mean other than my obvious insanity?
Yeah. Well, I didn't want to mention that, Kelly.
There's very specific reasons behind both. When I first started writing in Nox Dormienda, which is the first Arcturus book, and that's a Latin title, and basically I translated it as A Long Night for Sleeping. It's essentially an homage to The Big Sleep, because Raymond Chandler is one of my favorite authors, and certainly the biggest influence on my prose style, and he was a classicist as well, and in training, as am I, and so it's sort of like a little fun homage to him. But anyway, I was in grad school when I could see the end coming, which is also known as graduation. And you know, I was faced with the choice of either moving forward academically, and I'd had a very successful career as an academic and had been published and already presented in many conferences around the world. But I decided, I could either go on and get my PhD, which is called a terminal degree, and I think in my case it may have been. And for that reason, because I really did not want to pursue the PhD, because I felt like it was narrowing my interest and narrowing my focus to the point of me feeling just feeling too locked in to dealing with very specific things that were interesting, but to me were not able to really express my creativity. I decided to just do a 180 and actually try to become a writer. So the first adage that, and I'd always written books and I'd written screenplays and I'd written poetry. I was always a writer. In my spare time. It was something I sort of took for granted, but I decided to actually try to do it professionally. And the thing that everyone tells you, and about the only piece of advice that I knew, was the common wisdom that you write what you know. And since what I knew at the time, I thought, you know, I'm paying this enormous amount of money to have this incredibly erudite education, teaching Greek and Latin and studying mystery religions and, you know, archaeology and art history and just on and on and on, philology and, you know, Homeric Greek and translating poetry and Sappho and just on and on and on. I thought, well, what can I do to, you really sort of justify this cost? So I thought, well, I'm going to try to write a book, you know, using some of this education, some of my knowledge, some of my intimate knowledge of Roman Britain, and my particular ethos, which is that, you know, I'm a very humanistic person. I'm a humanist, an old-fashioned humanist, and I realized after spending all this money that people haven't changed enormously since the ancient world. And I wanted to sort of use that education to encourage people to have an interest in it, and maybe even engage readers who don't have a particular interest in it. So that's what happened with Arcturus. And, you know, I chose the noir medium because, again, Chandler was one of the greatest stylists of the 20th century American literature. And he and Hammett were two of my major influences. Although my background in reading and study is very wide and extends, as I said, from ancient Greek literature through Shakespeare and Elizabethan playwrights through a lot of 19th century British literature. And when the thing about being a writer is whatever you read has an influence on you, but these were direct influences. And I really just wanted to write a series that sort of, took the noir lens and translated history through it. Because the way I think about history, when we present it to an audience as historical fiction writers, is that you're really translating the past in a way that makes people understand it, hopefully, that makes people feel the connection that they need to feel to it. And to me, my translation device was more.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned Raymond Chandler because I follow you on Twitter, and you recently tweeted that all mystery writers owe a debt to Raymond Chandler, and now you've expanded beyond the 140 characters that Twitter limits you to.
Oh yeah, I could go on and on. I mean, Chandler's a really interesting person, as well as just a fantastic writer. And the thing that resonated with me about his writing is that I grew up reading and writing a great deal of poetry. Sonnets were always my preferred form. I'm not one of those free-flowing beat kind of people. I'm a little more old-fashioned than that. I like structure. I like
rhyme. Give me a rhyme.
Exactly. To me, you know, without any structure, there's no point to it, because the point is the structure presents a format that allows people to have access to your work. And I'm not a writer or I don't particularly care for art that actually tries to keep people away from understanding it. To me, all art and all creativity is an exercise in communication. If you wanted, if it's an exercise only in self-expression, then you can just go do it in a corner and get out of my face. So that's me. So, you know, Chandler has a very lyrical style, and because I grew up, as I said, really immersed in poetry, Coleridge, Blake, Wordsworth, Tennyson, Kipling, on and on and on, and many of the writers that I admire the most, people like Tennessee Williams, he's my favorite American playwright. I mean, they're imbued with this very strong sense of lyricism, which I also try to maintain in my work. And Chandler has that within the noir idiom in spades. So I really identified with him. And then, of course, later after I decided, you see a pattern emerging that I don't want to be boxed in. When Not Stormy Enda became a success and won the Bruce Alexander Award, I didn't know that was going to happen. And in the meantime, I had decided, I love Rome and I do know a lot about it. I know a lot about the culture, but I do want to try to write other things. And I want to write a sort of mainline noir set in a noir town in a noir era. My city in 1940. I wanted the shake-up here with Miranda Corby and what became the Miranda Corby series and City of Dragons, the first novel, was that I wanted to create a noir in which the woman is the main focus, that a woman who has all the attributes of the much maligned and stigmatized femme fatale. In other words, she's sexy, she's beautiful, she knows she's sexy and uses it to manipulate people. She's extremely intelligent, she's strong, she's ambitious, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. A woman with all these characteristics is actually the hero. She's in the Seamus shoes and not the villain, not the demonized, sexualized woman that I saw as a scholar extending way back to archaic Greek poetry, going back to the Bible, going back to just about as long as we've told stories, and men have told stories. There have been depictions of women as a threat, and these women are almost always characterized in the same way that noir characterizes femme fatales. So that was sort of my intellectual approach to writing Miranda and why I wrote that series. And why I wrote it in San Francisco is easy. I live here. I love the city. And it is one of the cities, like Los Angeles, that has a very strong noir tradition.
Well, it's interesting. I found the time period particularly interesting because it, as we mentioned, it is right before the U.S. enters World War II, although the war is raging in Europe. And those preconceived, Miranda is at a time that's right on the cusp of the beginning of the shakeup in the roles of women. And so that, you know, looking at it from where we are now, 70 years on, we know that things are going to change. Miranda doesn't. And you stay very true to that. She's very, you know, she's sang froid about the way things are, but not about playing by the rules. She's got an agenda, and she's not afraid to let people know that she has an agenda. She's not coy in any way about her what she wants to do.
No, she's not, and, you know, she's written from a very specific socioeconomic standpoint, which is, you know, I grew up as a child of lower-middle-class parents and was the first person in my family to be able to go to college. And it has nothing to do with aptitude, talent, or intelligence. It has everything to do with economic opportunity. My grandfather was a coal miner. On my father's side was a coal miner from Kentucky who died of black lung disease in one of the poorest regions in America. My other grandfather, you know, worked in Chicago and was a son of Polish immigrants and also had to face a great deal, as did my grandmother, who wound up, you know, having to leave school and work in a factory when she was, you know, 13 or 14. So this is the 20th century. And you know, I'm sorry to rain on anyone's parade of the American dream, but the American dream is still very much unrealized for a great many people in this country, and always has been. And for every Horatio Alger story that makes you weep and run to buy something else, because they're usually trying to sell you something when they tell it to you, there are millions of people who never have the opportunity to fulfill their ambition or to realize their talent. And Miranda is writing from that very specific point of view, because she is one of those people who is very smart and very talented, but because of the circumstances of her birth, through the structure of the era that she's living in which she had less power even than people do now, and they still don't have much, you know, she's limited. So she is a self-made woman. And she's fighting to attain that sort of independence and survival, just raw survival. And of course, there has been a period, because you've read the books, when she didn't want to survive because, you know, she's lost the one person that she trusted more than anything else, the one person that she loved. And it's very, very difficult to come back from a devastation like that, which she lost her lover in the Spanish Civil War. So when we see her, when we meet her for the first time in City of Dragons, she is rebuilding. You know, she is rebuilding a life and redefining a life and really redefining what her life and what her potential is.
Well, I saw her as damaged but not destroyed.
Exactly. Exactly. That's how I see her as well. I think She's broken. She's cracked, but she's not broken. You know, she's China that has fissures running through it. She's not crumbled, and she's not going to be crumbled. she's determined.
Because we have hopefully many more Miranda books to come, and that actually brings me to one question I had about City of Ghosts. You know, she evolves from looking, in the beginning of the book, she's looking for a lost jade necklace. And as a matter of fact, you open the book with the scene of her finding it.
Right.
But the story evolves into, you know, some of the more unsavory things that the Germans were doing in the still neutral United States. And I don't want any spoilers because people really should read this. And it made me wonder if Miranda is going to become more involved in these sort of intelligence intrigues in future novels.
Well, I personally would love that. I mean, I would like to see her become more involved in that aspect because it was here. The Germans were very active. The Nazis were very active in Central and South America. And Hoover was extremely paranoid about Mexico, and he may actually have had reason to be paranoid about Mexico. They had there was a fascist group in Mexico that was being financed by the Germans. It was similar to the Black Shirt, Oswald Mosley's group in England.
And there were
these kinds of fascist militias, if you want to call it, or groups everywhere. The problem with going in that direction is that Miranda is essentially an independent contractor. So I wouldn't want her to do it as a steady diet, but obviously her heart is in the, you know, her heart is always about social justice, and there's nothing on earth she detests more than the idea of the Nazis, you know what I mean? And she saw what the war was doing in Spain, and she saw, because there were atrocities committed on both sides, but, you know, the fault of that war was with the fascists, as most crimes were in that period. So, you know, I could see her definitely becoming more involved if she winds up going to England, and I'm not going to give that away.
Oh, quite yet,
but if she does, I mean, I could see that happening. I also, you know, because I think of Miranda almost as someone, as one of those crazy writer things, but I kind of see Miranda as someone who sort of tells her story to me in bits and pieces. And I've often felt that, you know, what I would love to do is get her through the war and then after the war have her become involved in the Alger Hiss case. That's something that's always interested me, and it's something that she would resonate with. Because, as you know, she would be considered very much of a potential troublemaker by the McCarthy types.
Definitely want to talk to her.
Yeah, and, you know, her friend Benta is a communist, and although she became very disenchanted with the official party line after the Molotov Pact and after Trotsky's killed. But, you know, I mean, so I've hopefully sown the seeds for, you know, a very compelling future as Miranda would age. If we're both around long enough to write about it, I'd be delighted. Because I'd really like to see her get through the war and into the Cold War and really deal with it. And that actually is the most sort of mainline period of noir, because noir as we know it in film, at least in film noir, really came to its fruition and climax with the anxiety and paranoia and overall disenchantment of the end of World War II, because, you know, the world had changed so dramatically. When the GIs came home, what they had been fighting for was no longer here. And that's the tragic thing, you know. You don't think that when the veterans return, they're fighting for a dream that's already been lost to some degree on an emotional basis. And when they come back, the world that they had tried to preserve was already gone just by the nature of the
And the angst that produced, I think, evolved into more and more noir. And I would also say more and more noir in California, in San Francisco and Los mm-hmm. Angeles, because this is the end of the continent. You can't go any further.
Oh, that's an excellent observation, Nancy. I totally agree. You know, the manifest destiny ends here.
I wish it was mine, but Megan Abbott wrote about it. So I have to give Megan her props.
Megan's terrific. She's a terrific writer and a friend, and she's always got something interesting to observe about noir. When you've got that tension of movement one way and resistance the other way, it leads to some very noir situations.
When we were at the Mystery Writers Conference at Book Passage in Corte Madera, you mentioned mm-hmm. that one of the ways you get into the 40s mindset for the Miranda Mysteries is by watching films from the era. And mm-hmm. what else do you do? Do you listen to music and read newspapers and magazines from the era to just to get into that mindset?
Oh, I have so much stuff. I mean, Nancy, I'm drowning in materials designed to act as a time capsule for me, because I'm an inveterate collector of old stuff. It was just things from that time period, you know, were so beautifully designed. We lived with a lot of beauty then, when you could afford to have that beauty and you had access to it and you weren't one of the marginalized people. You had a lot of access to beauty. And I mean, I'm talking about things from just quotidian things like matchbooks to the way buildings were designed. You know, you had care in the design and experience of buying things that we no longer have. Now it's all about saving a buck and going into something that's in a giant box or staying online. And it's, you know, beauty is not a selling point. So I tend to collect oddball things from the time period and always have. I've got a large selection of things from the World Fair in 1939 and 1940. So I will look at all kinds of ephemera. It's basically mostly paper ephemera, everything from postcards to brochures. Like, I have a very, the brochure that, just to give you an example of how I use it, there's a brochure from 1940. About, like, what to do on your night out in San Francisco. And essentially, it was one of those sort of flyers that people put out and has ads for various businesses to, say, out-of-town Rotary people or you know, Lions Club members or something that were coming into town, conventioneers. And so you had ads for, like, nightclubs and bars, and there were ads for escort services in this. And I have it, you know, and that's actually where Diane's escort service came from. It was an actual escort service in San Francisco. So everything that you read about Diane's, with the exception of her character, which is obviously that has to be fictionalized, but their address, their phone number, everything else, that was all real. It was based on an actual escort service. So that's the kind of thing I do. I look at this ephemera. I look at matchbooks. I look at bits and bobs. I have a very wide collection of Life magazines, which I find to be very, very in the moment, especially the letters to the editor. You can read about news in Life and other magazines, and you can see sort of what the editorial slant is. Henry Luce was a bit of a conservative. But one of the things that's very interesting to me is to read the letters to the editor, because then you're getting feedback from just quote-unquote normal people. And, you know, we were in a very, very isolationist country in 1940. It started to change very slowly, mainly thanks to newscasters like Murrow, who were broadcasting from England and bringing home sounds and sights and images from what they were suffering through the Blitz, and also from Hollywood, who were trying to sort of give us a steady diet, God bless them, of what the British were going through and the threat that the Nazis represented to everyone. But, you know, when we meet Miranda in February of 1940, it's a very isolationist country. And that comes through in things like the Life magazine, Letters to the Editor. I actually have a giant hardbound book that weighs like 50 pounds. It's a volume of the San Francisco News, that's actual bound newspaper. So so much stuff. So I look through this when I'm starting a new book or a new project, to give me ideas, to get inspiration, to do research. And of course, my my one piece of ephemera that I use the most often, and I continue to use it obviously when I'm writing the books, is my 1940 phone book, which is, oh, it's probably about 3 inches thick, Pacific Telephone and Telegraph book from the Bay Area with yellow pages, and that's just terrific. When I need a name, I can look in the white pages. When I need a business for Miranda, she has to go to a dry cleaner, as she does in City of Dragons, or she has to rent a car, as she does in City of Secrets, or a costume store, as she does in City of Ghosts. I can look in that book in my directory and have her go to an actual store, which gives me a lot of pleasure because I'm a geek about that. And if I know that some of the detail and most of the detail in my book is actually accurate, then it helps me visualize it. And if I can feel like this could be true, then I'm hoping to convey that same sense of veracity to my readership.
Well, one of the things I noticed when I read the books, especially the Miranda books, is the attention to detail when it comes to what Miranda wears, and her mm-hmm. dresses, her undergarments, shoes, hats, and mm-hmm. especially her perfume. She talks a lot about how the perfume that she likes to wear, which is from France, is not going to be available anymore. Mm-hmm. And that, right. to me, that's almost like a leitmotif that goes through this book. Mm-hmm. Of, you know, because smell is a sensory, the smell of particular perfume brings back memories of the lover she lost, and it's all tied in, and I thought that was there was a lot of poignancy in that for me, and I'm a little obsessed with perfume, so.
When I'm dealing again with an act of translation here, I'm trying to take a period of time that people may think they know. And they may know it and they may not know it. They may just have an impression of it, as most people do, from watching many old movies. And you know, because of censorship rules in Hollywood that were put in place in 1934, what you see in old Hollywood movies, as good as they may be, as many of them may be, is not true to life. People did not sleep, for the most part, in two little beds with a nightstand in the middle, you know, which you'd be surprised how many people think this is real, you know. So when I'm writing, I try to use sensory detail to really make people feel as though they're there. I want to give them a time capsule experience. I want to transport them back to 1940 as it really was. And that means you're going to have good smells and bad smells. Now, the good smells... I'm a big perfume fan. I love fragrance, and to me, fragrance is, and maybe in the past even more so than today, was very much of a signature. You know, women were known, famous women were often known to be supporters of one fragrance or another, and they were, you know, they were sort of anticipated before they walked into the room because of the scent. And that's sort of the era that I'm trying to recapture. With Miranda, it's a little bit more complex because the perfume signifies a change, a great and grave change in her, because of the loss of her lover. As has mentioned, I think in most in City of Dragons and City of Secrets, but then you sort of get the backstory of the perfume change in City of Ghosts. You know, she used to wear a perfume called Gervienne by the House of Worth, and it had a certain smell. Now, you know, when I was researching this, they don't make that perfume anymore. I had to go try to find an old bottle on eBay. I was successful. I had to research this and really come up with a perfume of the kind of perfume that you might have if you have a little bit more idealism and you're a little bit younger and you're in New York for the first time and things may suddenly, for the first time in your life, it may seem like there's such a thing as hope. That's sort of the perfume that she had when she knew Johnny. And when she lost Johnny, as you find out in City of Ghosts, her perfume changed. Because of, and I'm not going to give a spoiler, but there's a scene in City of Ghosts with the English soldier, and she starts to wear Golden Lee, which was a very famous fragrance of the 30s, and it was associated, means of course night flight, and it was associated with aviation. It was associated with the great female aviators, the aviatrixes. in the 30s, and Amelia Earhart, of course, being the most famous of them, but not the only famous woman pilot of the time. There were a number that she was actually sort of in friendly rivalry with. So it's a perfume that signifies danger, and it signifies adventure. It signifies flying over, obviously, your past and sort of distance and a lot of other things. And it is by the House of Guerlain, which I'm happy to say is still around. I happen to really enjoy Guerlain perfume. As I said, that, and as you noted, the perfume is a theme. It is a leitmotif, and it's also very much a part of, it's a metaphor for her change in character and how she's dealing with the grief that really just almost destroyed her when she lost Johnny.
So I take it the next, and this is my last question of the interview, I take it the next Miranda Corby novel is completed.
I wish, Nancy. Yeah, I'm trying to get this thing cranked out. It's late. It's way late, and it's been for a number of reasons, some personal, and just some dealing with family. It's been a tougher novel to write. You know, when I lost my parents, there was a hiatus between books, and that was finishing City of Ghosts was probably the hardest thing I had to do. But I had a great deal of City of Ghosts written, and I had started the book, obviously, when my parents were alive, and then I had to finish it when I had lost them. That was an excruciating process, but I was able to get through it, and it was also somewhat therapeutic. This City of Sharks, which is the next one, is the first book I've actually had to start and finish, which it's almost finished, when I don't have my parents. So it's been a slower book, but you know, I'm pleased with the progress. I just, you know, I feel anxiety from my readers because I do get emails saying, well, when's the next one coming out? And it's like, I'm trying, really, I am. I want to get these things out quicker than I have been able to, and I'm hoping that I can, you know, work on my word count, speed, and write as quickly as I used to. It's just been a hard process dealing with my own grief, and, you know, it's coming along, though. It's almost finished.
I think of it as falling into a series. And mm-hmm. once you fall into a series, it becomes part of you. And mm-hmm. you think about these people. I like to think how the writers think about them, that they are people that live in a universe that you get a window into. And
right.
you want to look through the window again. So it's not being greedy, and we don't want to force you. We don't want to frog march you to your keyboard. But I was curious about City of Sharks. And I mean, for those who have read the most recent City of Ghosts, there are clues into what Miranda might do.
Yeah, there are definitely clues. Let me tell you this much. I wanted to, before she has the potential of really getting to England, I wanted to, it was just a giant move for Miranda because San Francisco is really her parental symbol. You know, I mean, San Francisco is her parent, sort of a mono parent, if you will, in her experience. So leaving it, the idea of leaving it, even though she may feel compelled to do that, it's quite a bit of trauma, and this is a trauma, voluntary trauma for someone, you know, who has what we would now call PTSD. Miranda suffers from that. She has flashbacks. She has trouble sleeping. You know, all of those issues she has. So I wanted to really give the weight that decision. I wanted to give that decision the weight it deserves. And I also wanted to have a chance to write about a couple of the places in San Francisco that I really just wanted to feature in the book. So I like to feature different settings as it's, you know, organic to the plot, obviously, and the character in each book. And in this particular case, it's Alcatraz and Playland at the Beach secondarily, but Alcatraz is sort of the inspiration to the title. It's a rare book because the title did not come after the plot. The plot came from the title. So it's, and the reason for that is because I have a very good friend, Julie Kramer, who's a terrific thriller writer, and we were published at the same time. You know, we sort of came up together as debut authors, and Julie's been after me for a long time to have a book called City of Sharks. She's like, you've got to have your next book be City of Sharks. So I said, you know what, let's make it City of Sharks. Because when I was looking around to think what's going to happen next, I realized, wait, that's interesting, because then ideas started coming to me through the title. And Alcatraz had been perfectly with that. So you have to, you know, I have to give Julie all the credit in the world for insisting that I have that title, because the title is sort of what sparked the plot in this particular case and sparked my ability to write about Alcatraz. So that's definitely going to be a featured setting in the novel. Seems like the last book was more, obviously had a lot of espionage in it because of the situation, you know, the setup with James and the State Department. And this book is going to be more of a straightforward mystery. Most, you know, City of Secrets, it was very personal, and it was obviously about anti-Semitism. And City of Dragons, again, very personal, dealing with racial tension in Chinatown. So, you know, she hasn't had really much of an opportunity to do a sort of a straightforward PI type of crime. Or at least one that seems to be a straightforward PI type of crime. And City of Sharks, I'm hoping, will give her that opportunity, at least on the surface. And it also, coincidentally, deals with the publishing world. So it's giving me an opportunity to, as a writer, to write about the process of writing, which is one of those temptations that most writers give into at least once.
Thank you so much for your time today and for talking to us about your books, your characters, your state of mind, and all of the things that go into your two series. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Oh, Nancy, thank you for having me. I mean, it's an absolute pleasure. To be able to talk to somebody like yourself, who is such a terrific critic and so knowledgeable about the genre, the wider genre of crime fiction and literature as a whole, and a fine writer in your own right. It's a real treat, and it's one of the things that, let's just say, it's one of the rewards we get for looking at the screen and filling that empty space. You know, obviously the reward is in the result of creating a book by itself, but it's nice to have other little perks too, and one of them is getting to talk to you.
I'm leaving that in.
Well, good, I hope so.
Next week, in anticipation of the opening of the NFL season, we'll be speaking to Bill Sikin about his debut mystery, Hangman's Game, a novel about an NFL punter who, after witnessing a murder, becomes embroiled in the investigation. And we'll also be speaking to Belinda Bauer about her remarkable Rubbernecker, which won the 2014 Theakston Old Peculiar Crime Novel of the Year. This is Nancy Clare. Thank you again for listening to Speaking of Mysteries.